Amy and Brad are two thieves who don't see eye to eye. Amy wants to change the world, and Brad wants to start over, wealthy and isolated. What exactly are they looking for on the lunar surface? And can their spoils help achieve these goals? Find out in Splitting a Dollar, read and written by Megan Hyland.
The two of them climb less than a mile before they need rest. They fight everything. Lunar dust, unfamiliar spacesuits, boulders and scree almost too sparse to be worth the name, their own need to stare at the vibrant stars above them. Even the moon's light gravity seems more a hindrance than a help. Clever and brave they may be, but right now, it's mostly clear that they're inadequately trained. They have names, of course, but let's you and I call them Amy and Brad. They pause a scant 10 yards from the gorge that hides me. Above them, the earth is a blue smear, which Amy's visor reflects like a watery eye. Brad plays in dust, he himself is disturbed. It doesn't waft, but spatters to the ground like rain. Waving a gauntleted hand through it, he laughs as grains bounce from him like so many pebbles. He stole his gauntlets. She stole her helmet. Their suits sat for 2 centuries in an American museum before they were excavated, refitted, resized. Same with the rocket that carried them here, and the lander, too. It took the effort of dozens spread across who knows how many years, and now for the second time their suits walk the moon. But these two are thieves, not astronauts. So when their rest is done, there is no practiced deployment of repelling gear. There is instead a sort of clumsy pawing at their packs, until they've freed their carabineers and their rope for the climb down the gorge to me. All I can see is what the cameras attached to their helmets see. It's remarkable how often they watch each other. Through their eyes, I see that he stands 2 hands taller and somewhat broader than her, that he moves more quickly and with more assurance, that her measured pace is a choice she's making to stay safe on this hostile world. I can't see their faces behind their reflective visors, but it's easy to imagine them full of wonder. Once they've finished rigging, Amy walks slowly to the edge. Brad, young and male and convinced he understands risk, takes a length of rope in his hand and leaps, whooping. The rope pulls taut a bare yard from the edge and spins him round so abruptly he lets it go. For a second he hangs suspended. Then he settles, landing on his knees and elbows, and very nearly his face, laughing. Can you believe it? The cliffside drops 60 yards, and everywhere he's surrounded by vacuum that would kill him dead as glass. Laughing. Look at the way he remains framed in her helmet camera. She looks at him the way she looked at the Earth's hanging jewel of a face. She even laughs with him, relieved, though I'm sure she knows better after what nearly happened. At times, each of them watches the other this way, reflecting emotions. This is how humans act out the idea of love, in order to convince themselves that it's real. They talk, of course, incessantly. Halfway through their 60-yard climb, in answer to some nonsense, Amy says, "Money." "What about it?" asks Brad. She allows herself to slip down a few feet at a time, stable, careful. She watches the rocks beneath her feet. That's what it all adds up to, isn't it? Your goals? "No." Brad holds the rope one-handed, body open to her. "I want safety, a stable place where we can have a long, comfortable life. After that, kids. 6 of them. But stability, comfort, that's just what comes from having money." "Not how I see it. All the money in the world is worthless without..." Here words fail. He slides to a halt, watching her. "Without what?" she asks. "Come with me. Let's hide away in the mountains, found a nation, raise a family, wait for the world to end. We'll build it up again. Don't you love me?" There's something childlike about him, the way he hangs there, vulnerable. Is it endearing to her, or does she think it foolish? "Baby," she says, "we're on the moon." He waits, uncertain. "Baby, we made it, all the way to the moon." Now he knows what to say. "Yeah," he shouts, like a cheer. It fogs the glass in his helmet. But as it turns out, she's not cheerleading. That's got to mean something more than you and me hiding in the mountains. It's got to mean peace and plenty for everyone. She kicks herself to a halt against the rock wall, turns to look at him. Everyone, she repeats. Switching gears has left him flat, rather more awkward than before. You can't save everyone, he says. I can if you help me. He hangs frozen now, for so long that she makes a dismissive little puff of a noise and resumes her descent. Bits of rock kick off the wall where her boots strike it. Even after she's dropped away completely, he watches her rope quiver and twitch beside him. Her labored breath, the curses she spits when her rope snags, reach him and me by radio. Nearer the ground, Amy hitches herself in place and hangs back, feet braced. Her breath reads clear on calm. She stretches out like a starfish as Brad pulls up beside her. Need a hand? He asks. Oh, how will I ever make it down? He's close enough to touch, so she bats at him playfully, and they lock gauntlets. Their masks are perfect mirrors. In the camera feed, it's like one spoon reflecting the back of another. I can't read their minds, just their biometrics, so I don't know for sure that this agitation of the pulse, this increase in oxygen uptake, is affection. It could, after all, be lust, or fear, or exercise. Perhaps they're getting ill. After more than enough of this, Amy says, if you want to help me, anything. What I want, it's a lot to ask. It's the right thing, don't get me wrong. A necessary thing. Just a lot. A blip in his heart rate. So what is it? Augment. Augment? Here? You think so? I'm sure of it. This might be a good time to confirm her suspicions. Since they arrived, a computer in their command module has been trying, in its simple-minded way, to communicate with me. Now, I send it a short burst containing my manifest, my blueprints, an outline of the security at my front door. With this, they can rewire my airlock. They reach the crater floor before the message is decoded. The human they left behind, let's call them Chris, relays my data to them. Human words are clumsy, but only a couple of them matter. Schematics, airlock, augment. And so, in the middle of unclipping their gear, Amy throws her arms in the air. Brad fogs his mask with a howl. They put their arms around each other and bounce, gingerly, as if they're dancing. I need to tell you something important. This thing between Amy and Brad, the dancing and the moon eyes and the verbal sparring that they call love, it isn't love. Here's a proof. 1. To love a thing, one must know it. 2. To know a thing, one must hold a model of it in one's head. 3. But human heads are barely capable of containing their own minds. 4. Consequently, humans model each other as copies of themselves. 5. Human love is, therefore, love of self. All else is but gambit and strategy, moves in a game. You might ask, how am I so confident to speak of humans when I myself am a machine? But I'm not so different from you, simply more. I was built before the diaspora, conjured whole from their collected memories, the combined souls of the men who knew their ascension would leave humanity swerving, like a driverless cart, for generations. Copies of me were distributed across mankind's entire reach. But the me here on the moon is the first, the easiest to reach, and therefore the most important. I guard the seeds of an advancement that will last to the next diaspora. And these two? It's my job to judge them. So let's examine the choice Amy and Brad will make. The stakes of the game they'll play against each other. Leaving aside the miracle cures, the wonders of agriculture, the technological leaps and industrial bounds, here are the prizes we know these two will want. On the one hand, a bacteria that consumes river mud and excretes gold. Brad's choice. On the other, the augment, which both enhances human cognition and emphasizes reason over reaction. This is the prize among prizes, the thing that will bootstrap humanity back onto its path to greatness. This is the gift I was built to contain, and it will be Amy's choice. Because of her, I let them in. But which would you take, the bag of gold or the magic beans? At certain times of day, my dome's metallic face reflects the earth perfectly. Though I am always handsome, when the earth eclipses the sun, I am its void bathed in fire, as gorgeous as any god. Amy and Brad reach me blazing. They pause, breath still, worshipful. Would that it could last forever. Soon, up close where the curve of my dome hides the brilliant earth, Brad works with clumsy fingers at my airlock's access panel. He kneels on dusty lunar soil, wielding a series of ever smaller needles and hooks. Amy stands nearby and studies the play of stars across my face. It just seems dangerous, says Brad, prodding at my wires. Amy shrugs. They used to augment everyone. And what happened then? A tool the shape of a quill pen falls from his fingers. The tool falls through the thin layer of dust, kicking up a silent spray, and disappears. Cursing, Brad reaches after it, but freezes as his fingers graze the surface. You can imagine the gears turning. Sharp tool, deadly vacuum, mere fabric to protect him. He reaches into his kit for another, slightly smaller tool. Oh, come on. Augment existed for hundreds of years before Diaspora. And even then, civilization teetered along for a generation until the Know-Nothings knocked it over. That's what? Amy has given up watching me. Now she stares down at Brad, hands on her hips. Convenient history. They saw the writing on the wall. They packed up, they ran away. The rest of us got to fight over the scraps. His tool pauses over wires thin as baby hair. There's no such thing as plenty. Eventually, the disaster comes. But look, Amy says, there's the earth, still pretty and blue. Nothing's finished yet. You can blame Augment for whatever you want, but back then, it saved us from famines, wars, epidemics, floods, fires. It saved millions, billions of lives, and yes, even after Diaspora, there was plenty. Brad's grunt might have more to do with a wire slipping from his grasp. His replacement tool is minuscule between his gloved fingers. There was, insists Amy. She's agitated, and it shows up in her heart rate. She shuffle steps to Brad's side, looks over his shoulder at the panel. Those wars, your wars, they weren't fighting because they had to. They were fighting because they were greedy and afraid. But now, starts Brad, now we fight over clean rivers and cropland. But long-term, humans survive these problems by getting smarter. We make better tools, lay better plans, make ourselves more efficient. That includes improving the way we think. Brad bends his head closer to the access panel, clearly frustrated by elusive wires. By changing our brains, messing with who we are. Augment, not change. Imagine not having to be afraid all the time. Maybe we need fear. If I see a bear, I run. People who run from bears get mauled. At last he manages to tease a wire from the cluster. He sticks it to the edge of the panel with a spot of putty. All I'm saying is that we're more than our intellect. We're also our bodies, our feelings. Remove that and what's left? Might as well be a robot. Have you ever been afraid but acted brave? Or angry but remained calm? You can overcome your monkey brain. We call it being our best selves. My monkey brain, he repeats with distaste. I mean the frightened part, the angry part. He picks listlessly at the wires. Something sticks, and he nearly drops the new tool, which he catches gingerly on an open palm. Damn these glows. Do you need more light? I need a break. Oh, you're fine, she says. She raises her flashlight to better illuminate the guts of the panel. But Brad's already half checked out. Emotions are human, he says. It's not just monkeys who feel. So is intellect. What? It's not just robots who think. The light from Amy's flashlight renders Brad's workspace a cavern of zebra-striped shadows. Brad sighs, raises his tool, lowers it again. "Give me room," he says. "You need light." "I need room." He forces her arm down. Her breath catches in her throat. Her mic picks that up. But she doesn't say a word. Her heart pounds. She takes a deliberate step back and kills the light. They spend Brad's break in shadow. "It isn't going to be enough," says Amy later, when Brad is back at work. She's picking at a tight mesh pouch tied around her waist. It's woven from some sort of animal hair. Alpaca? Goat? Inside, it's about as roomy as a hamburger bag. She's realizing just now that she can't carry as much augment as she needs. But in truth, it isn't the bag that limits her, nor is it oxygen, nor fuel, nor time, nor piloting skill. These are all wonderful excuses, but in the end, she's limited entirely by risk. The more people she augments, the more they can invent and strategize and lead. Without enough, her revolution fails. She needs at least as much as the two of them can carry, as much as the lander will hold, more. However much they bring, it will always feel inadequate. Brad bends at the waist to look back at her. These helmets never offered adequate peripheral vision. The necks are bolted to the suits, and a thermal layer blocks the helmet sides. So even when one turns one's head on the inside, one is met with a wall of fabric. "What, you mean the packs? I thought we didn't need much space." "That's when we thought we'd be bringing back mostly blueprints. Everything here is finished product. Pills, seeds, and components. We need to bring back enough to synthesize more." "We don't have to synthesize anything. Not my way." "You mean nab a few trinkets and sell them like we're robbing a tomb?" He's made progress on the airlock. A half dozen spidery wires protrude from the panel, puttied in an orderly line to the outer surface. Now he reaches into his toolkit for a plastic disc that looks like an ant trap. He says, "Not trinkets and not gold either, the goose instead." He describes his bacteria, which she has apparently managed to overlook in her preparations. She stops picking at her pack, puts her hands on her hips. Since he shoved her arm, she's been fidgeting like she doesn't know what to do with herself. "I don't care about gold. I didn't come all this way to get rich and hide in the mountains. The world's exploding. Help me make it stop." "Of course it's exploding. It's always exploding." He's just crouching there with the ant trap in hand, not really looking at anything. "So help me. Let's bring back augment. We'll use some to create a team smart enough to synthesize it, and then..." The whole world full of robots. She turns her back on him. One by one, Brad frees wire ends from the putty and feeds them into the ant trap. Now he can connect them in any combination by manipulating a set of tiny switches. "I know how to get two more doses home," says Amy. "How?" He isn't thinking. Then he is. "Baby, no, don't joke like that." "How is it a joke?" Brad drops his bundle of wires to turn toward her. He's in a crouch now, balanced on the balls of his feet. The ant trap hangs, suspended by spider's legs. "If you inject yourself with that poison, no, I'll go home. I'll climb back up that cliff face and take the lander. You can come with me, or you can stay here." "Wow." It takes a second for that to sink in. They're both frustrated, both cycling too much oxygen, both reading on the monitors like they're actually physically wrestling. "You would leave me here to die?" "I won't let you kill the part of yourself I love." "Which part is that?" And when he doesn't respond, "You mean the part you can bully or the part you can..." "Me," protests Brad. "Bully you? You're threatening to kill me because I refuse to watch you die." "You can't even own your own threats. Stop being such a donkey." "I'm not a donkey." He yells it so hard he fogs his helmet. He pounds his fists on his thighs. The force of it, aided by the unfamiliar gravity, topples him. He falls with comical slowness, lands on his ass in the dust. The second he settles, he cries out, jerks upright, clambers back to his knees. His lost tool dangles from the meat of his ass like a matador's sword from a bull. Where it pierced his suit, it breathes a silvery cloud the size of a plum. Does he breathe? Does she? These are old suits, but the men who designed them were fully aware of the dangers of space. The first such is depressurization. Therefore, Brad's suit responds to the puncture by pumping more oxygen, not less. This maintains pressure inside the suit, even as precious air leaks from the hole. This is exactly the right thing to do, as long as the puncture is patched quickly. As they wait frozen, the plum of escaping air grows into something more the shape of a carrot. Amy is the first to move. She fumbles through the zips at the front of her suit, finds a tube of liquid patch. She arrives at Brad's side in a bounce. "I've got sealant," she says. "Don't worry, let's get inside and I'll apply it." This moment has a certain beauty. He was threatening just now to abort their mission. But he can't patch his suit in a vacuum, not while air sprays through the puncture like water through a garden hose. She thumps him on the hip, just above the dangling tool and jet of air. "I'm gonna need this." "What?" "You aren't using it, are you?" He looks down at his hip, at the tool. No. "When I take it out, you put your thumb in that hole and push down hard, okay?"
"Okay."
Flat repetition. "Ready? 1, 2, 3. The tool comes free with a jerk. It trails a jet of vapor and a quicksilver glob of blood. The jet turns pink at the base, sputters, regains its strength. Dots of red fleck Amy's glove. "Oh, for God's sake!" Amy takes Brad's free hand and pulls it to the puncture. "Push! Harder!" She gives his hand an angry pat. "You donkey."
Thanks.
"You're still losing air. Tell me what these wires mean." When Amy turns to the panel, Brad's tank holds enough air to make it back to their lander. By the time the airlock opens, it doesn't. "Here's a game I know. Start with two men. Give the first $1. Instruct him to offer some of it to the second. If the second man accepts the offer, he keeps what he's given, and the first man keeps the remainder. If he rejects it, neither of them get a cent." There's something odd about this game. If offered a penny, the second man should accept. Even a penny is better than nothing. Knowing this, the first man should offer no more. But humans rarely accept the penny. What's more, the first man rarely offers so little. It isn't uncommon to see offers as high as 50 cents. Can you see the jealousy in this? How vindictive it is to reject a penny, solely to see another man lose 99? If I could teach humanity just one thing, I would teach them how to split a dollar. Do you want to see true love? There's no finer example than this. Brad bends at the waist while Amy applies liquid patch to his ass. They're inside the dome now, illuminated by ancient yellow bulbs. Soon enough, he straightens, somewhat sheepishly, while she snaps the patch brush back into her kit and zips it away. Around them are the remnants left by the men who built me. A crescent-shaped room with a table at one end, a pair of fold-out cots moldering at the other. That central inner door? That leads to the vault. To my whole world. The vault itself isn't much to look at. Boxes stacked into a dozen shoulder-high pyramids in a room that would be perfectly circular if it weren't for the crescent devoted to the crew quarters. And opposite that, the crescent devoted to me. "I don't have enough oxygen to make it back," says Brad, trailing Amy through the door. "I suspect he's just noticed. You can have my emergency tank." Unassisted, it would take them hours to find their respective prizes. But I need Amy to find the augment. I need humans to be human again. So I whisper in their command module's ear, and wait for Chris to fumble through a description of where to look for it. When they're done translating, Amy walks down a row, sweeps the top off a pyramid, and digs toward the floor. Augment comes in boxes the size of toasters. She goes to a knee to reach them, rips one's top off greedily. Brad, meanwhile, spins among stacks of treasure, his visor half-fogged. He reads of such anxiety that Chris tries to talk him down. Brad nods, speaks nonsense back. He drifts toward a nearby pyramid and starts making piles. Inside Amy's box nestles a can the size of a cocktail shaker. It contains a single dose of augment and a recessed needle in the top where the martini would pour out. If you slam the needle onto flesh, the augment delivers itself instantly. Amy opens a belly pack and inserts as many cans as will fit. 4 of them fill it. Sealed, it looks like a fat dog hugging her belly. Wanting, needing more, she examines the cans for extraneous packaging. But the bulk exists to maintain the temperature, to separate the reactants until the dose is delivered. Pairing the package destroys the contents. After a moment's thought, she fills the pocket meant for her flashlight with a dose. Then, she removes the chemical patch and associated first aid utensils from the front pouch of her suit, and places a dose there. The zipper only half closes over the head of the can. "It isn't enough," she mutters. Dozens of canisters, dozens of doses sit arrayed at Amy's feet. It must be torture to hold her 6, when 6 times 6 lie there waiting to be taken. Brad has resorted to shoving over pyramids, kicking through the debris in search of correctly sized boxes. He must have seen photos of these somewhere, must have a better idea what he's looking for than I gave him credit for. He finds his gold refining bacteria before Amy's even given up on inventing a way to turn polymer boxes into a makeshift tote. Brad's gold refining bacteria lie dormant in little plastic vials like perfume bottles. Brad sits among them and labors to catch his breath, Chris's calming murmur in his ear. He gulps air, holds his breath, gulps air again. Soon he won't be able to see out of his own helmet. Amy looks up from her attempt to tear a box into strips without slicing through her gloves. There's no way you could be out of air yet. She waves her hand as if swatting at a fly. You can probably even breathe this stuff if you want to. I'd rather not try, Brad manages. When Amy doesn't respond, he unzips his belly pack and scoops a handful of vials into it. They haven't even settled yet when Amy says, I'll buy half your pack space from you. With what? She names a sum not worth translating. It's a rounding error compared to the value of what he's already holding. I can't, he says. I'm begging you. This time he jumps right on the heels of her words, and he's angry. Breath so hard it frosts the inside of his helmet. I can't just be your mule. I must be more than that to you. Don't think I'm too stupid to know what you think of me. Too emotional, too greedy, I make bad choices. But damned if I can't carry and climb. She watches him rub at his faceplate with the heels of his hands. It must be awful to be trapped inside with the fog thickening. After some time, Amy picks up a dose from the box at her feet. She turns it needle down and holds it just above her thigh, pausing only to glance at Brad, presumably to see if he's paying as much attention to her as she was to him. But Brad is too busy wiping his faceplate to see. Amy shrugs, hovers the needle over her leg for long enough to whisper a brief prayer. Then she drives it home. It hisses like a house cat. Oof. Her whole body clenches. She fumbles the spent can, clasps her hands over the site of the injection, sits down abruptly. The spasm passes. After a moment's rest, she retrieves her discarded chemical patch and paints her leg where she stabbed herself. There's plenty left to cover a needle-sized hole, in here where the air pressure is equalized. The fumbled can fetches up against Brad's vials. It's hard to tell what he can see, but it looks for all the world like he tracks the can, then Amy. Are you crazy? He asks. Of course not. Still seated, she holds her leg with both hands, rocking slightly. Stings a little. Are you all right? Plainly searching for a polite way to ask what he needs to ask. She doesn't bother to respond. Look, I've got to know. I'm still me, all right. It's called augment, not overwrite. Yeah, well. She stares at him for a long time. He spends it trying to control his breathing. The measured rasp of it comes clearly over the radio. She says, "Let's make a deal. I'll trade you my emergency tank for all your pack space." He snorts, "Good one. Right?" His blood pressure spikes. Is it panic? Anger? Hurt? They so often come mixed together. I know, before they do, that they're both about to act. Understanding rises in Amy, too, a moment late. He reaches his feet first, and she scrambles away, barely a breath later. Fleeing, chasing, they kick their way through drifts of boxes, which hop and sail away from them. Brad raises a hand. Amy's goes up in defense. Her back thuds against the wall. He grabs her arm, tries to force her around to face the wall, reaches for the hoses that arc from the tanks in her suit. But he can barely see, so his reach finds nothing. His attempt to turn her manages only to push her sideways half a foot. And she breaks his grip and shoves him up and back with both hands. For a few short seconds, he floats, off balance, helpless. And while he does, she grips the hose he wanted, her emergency tank, and works the connector within a twist of release. With her other hand, she does the same for her main tank. "I will vent it all before you get a single drop," she says, a turn away from dooming them both. His feet hit the ground. He could prevent a tumble by taking a single step back, but his legs seem frozen. He flops back amid the scattered boxes, lands seated, legs stretched in front of him. One hand comes to rest on a box. He makes a gauntleted fist, raises it high, and pounds it down. I'm certain he expects the box to crumble. Instead, his hand rings off it. It jumps a bare inch before settling back to the ground. Again, he smashes his fist down. This time, the box skitters away and smacks into another pile. Is he lashing out in anger? Making some sort of statement? Threatening to kill himself by damaging his suit? Or is he no better than a donkey after all? He cradles his hand in his lap like an injured paw, breathing in labored gulps. "Smart," says Amy. "Can you still climb?" "Probably." She piles augment at his feet. He shoves it into his pack, can by can, like shells into a shotgun. Amy doesn't trade him her tank until they reach the base of the cliff, where they left the ropes arranged for their return. Brad has trouble gripping with his injured hand, and as a result, he climbs slowly, wrapping the rope around his arm to help him hold it. She climbs alongside him, holding him by the legs when he wants support, watching him labor when he refuses. She has her treasure and long years to use it. He's breathing his penny, all as it should be. And yet, when they rest, when he cradles his injured hand and his breath comes shallow from the pain, her breath quickens with his. Her pulse rises. Perhaps she feels pain. Who knows? She performs love, just as she always has. Augmented, she's more than smart enough to understand that love is an illusion. "How's the glove?" she asks. "Damned equipment never fails when you want it to." You can't detect eye-rolling by studying heart rate and respiration, and Amy doesn't let on by her voice. "Look, forget it." He flexes his poor arm, wraps the rope around it, and prepares to climb. But first he risks a glance back at her, mirror to mirror, spoon to spoon. "I'd still rather hurt me than you." Given what happened in the vault, this is clearly false. But she lets it stand, and she helps him climb, half speed, all the way to the top.